For years, it lay in an iron box, buried so deep inside me that I was never sure just what it was. I knew I carried slippery, combustible things, more secret than sex and more dangerous than any shadow or ghost. Ghosts had shape and name. What lay inside my iron box had none. Whatever lived inside me was so potent that words crumbled before they could describe. Sometimes I thought I carried a terrible bomb. I had caught glimpses of destruction. In school, when I had finished a test before time was up or was daydreaming on my way home, the safe world fell away, and I saw things I knew no little girl should see. Blood and shattered glass, piles of skeletons and blackened barbed wire with bits of flesh stuck to it, the way flies stick to walls after they are swatted dead. Hills of suitcases, mountains of children's shoes, whips, pistols, boots, knives, and needles. At night, when my parents went out and my younger brother and I sat watching television, our room, our very lives seemed unsafe and unguarded. Burglars and murderers might enter our apartment at any time and catch us unprepared. I made my brother my lieutenant and marched him off to the kitchen to be armed. I chose a potato masher, wooden spoons, and two long knives from the drawer. And we stood vigil by the door until the scare paled, or I was too tired to stand guard anymore. Burglars and murderers, the words came in a pair, were always at large, liable to break up a party or disrupt my class in school, or even take 3,000 people out of Carnegie Hall. They would storm through the doors in their black boots and jackets, shoot their guns, or just point them at people shouting, "Out! Quickly!" until everyone had filed out and the place was empty. During the day, in the New York City streets, it was hard to imagine where these thousands of people would go. It was in the subways at rush hour that I saw them again. I stood, my face pressed to the glass in the first car beside the engineer's booth, watching the signals in the tunnel. The 7th Avenue local became a train of cattle cars on its way to Poland. I closed my eyes as the train rumbled from station to station, willing the conductor to disregard the red signals, to rush ahead at full speed and crash the passengers to their deaths before they reached their destination. There would be no burial. The passengers would vanish. In St. Patrick's Cathedral on 5th Avenue, there was a way of remembering people who were dead, even if they didn't have graves. I would take a long, thin taper from the rack beside the thick pillars and light a row of my own. I watched how the people prayed, how they dropped to their knees in the aisle, crossed the air with their fingers, and then hurried out with their heads lowered. I did the same. I had to, or else that group of men in black boots and shiny jackets might turn up and take me away. Sometimes I felt my iron box contained a tomb. The walls were stone, like those guarding the mummies in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the air was cool. My grandmother Helena sat in one corner on a chair like a throne. Her brown hair was swept up above her ears, and she looked stern, although my father always said she had never hurt a soul. My grandfather Maximilian stood beside her, erect and tall like a military man. My grandfather Emil paced back and forth, arguing with himself in German, and my grandmother Josephine stood dreaming in a corner, dressed in shawls. I did not know what the rest of them looked like. My uncle Eric and his wife and son, my uncle Bruno, my mother's first husband, Pepik, the one she had been married to before the war, and all the others who were never even called by name. Our family tree had been burned to a stump. Whole branches, great networks of leaves had disappeared into the sky and ground. There was no stone that marked their passage. All that was left were the fading photographs that my father kept in a yellow envelope underneath his desk. Those photographs were not the usual kind of snapshots displayed in albums and shown to strangers. They were documents, evidence of our part in a history so powerful that whenever I tried to read about it in the books my father gave me, or see it in the films he took me to, I could not take it in. The facts bounced like ping-pong balls inside my head, not only making no sense of their own, but disordering whatever was already there. The facts were these. Just before the outbreak of the Second World War, there were nearly 9 million Jews living in country villages, provincial towns, and large metropolitan centers throughout Europe. 7 years later, in Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Germany, and Austria, 90% of them had disappeared. In Czechoslovakia, where my father's family had lived for nearly 500 years, more than 85% of the Jews were gone. In Greece, Holland, Hungary, White Russia, the Ukraine, Belgium, Yugoslavia, Romania, and Norway, half or more of the Jews who had been living there before the war had vanished by the time it was over. 35 million people had died in this war. Most of them were soldiers who had been killed in battle, and to whose memory hundreds of monuments and military cemeteries had been built all over the world. 5 million of them were political prisoners, dissidents, anti-fascists of various nationalities, homosexuals and gypsies who had been murdered by the Nazis. 6 million, or 2 out of every 3 Jews in Europe, had also been murdered. For the murdered 11 million, there were no graves. They had been gassed and then burned, like my grandmother Helena, my grandfather Maximilian, and their sons, or shot into an open ditch like my grandmother Josephine and my grandfather Emil.